Anyone who looks at schools closely with an open mind and a sense of proportion becomes aware what childish places they are, how many kids and even teachers are held prisoner in a childhood they would willingly leave if they knew how and if the institution permitted it. If we're going to talk about childishness as we are, we need to agree on some definitions. So I'd like you to mentally create a yardstick, a continuum from childlike on one side, that's the condition we expect from young children, innocent, dependent, trusting, obedient, respectful, anxious to please, all the way across on the other side to childish. The palette of childishness includes selfishness, irresponsibility, boredom, envy, inconsiderate behavior, whining, cowardice, at least frequently, and in general, a lack of emotional proportion and self-discipline. Childish people need to be attended to by adults. That's important, so don't forget it. It's an important clue to what's really going on. Okay, now contrast that childlike to childish continuum with another familiar designation, the word youthful. Youthful offers quite a positive window on human character, opens up an entirely different catalog of adjectives: adventurous, energetic, curious, resilient, indomitable, surprising, open to new experience. Very few schools, including very few private schools, could possibly contain youthfulness, let alone encourage it. I hope you recognize the paradox in that. We have an institutional structure which finds itself compelled to suppress those very qualities which are universally acknowledged to be passports of success in Western society. Schools ask kids to remain childlike well beyond its natural term, but if they can't get childlike, they will settle for its toxic cousin, childish. The most radical thing I have to say to you, I'm going to say now, this has not gone on for a century without it serving some rational purpose. Remember, rationality and reasonableness are two different things. I know you think schools are unreasonable, so do I. That's why you homeschool. But that is a far cry from proving them irrational, and you'll see what I mean as we proceed. Secondary school wasn't the only way to grow up until after 1945. We tend to forget that. Indeed, even 10 years after 1945, the fast food dropout geniuses I talked about earlier were putting together a profound new way of life for all of us without benefit of diplomas or degrees. Even today in wealthy Switzerland, less than one kid in four goes beyond elementary school. If you knew that, would you raise your hand? And yet you live in one of the wealthiest communities on planet Earth, and it's full of sharp people and heavy-duty news reporting. How come, I'm not indicting you, how come no one bothered to tell you that three out of four kids, more than that, in Switzerland, don't go beyond elementary school? You did hear, as I did yesterday and the day before, that Switzerland has just announced that one out of every 39 of its citizens are millionaires in terms of cash. That's not counting their stocks, their real estate holdings, just in cash. One out of 39 Swiss are millionaires, including many, many people who only have an elementary school education. The school journalists and pedagogues in America haven't bothered to tell you about Switzerland. That in itself is a paradox, don't you think? For most of our own history, most kids did not go to secondary school. Yet the unschooled rose to be admirals like Farragut, inventors like Edison, captains of industry like Carnegie and Rockefeller, presidents like Washington and Lincoln, writers like Herman Melville, or scholars like Margaret Mead. People who reached age 13 were not looked upon as children. I'll give you a shocking example of that. Does anybody in this room possess that history of the world that the readers, Book of the Month Club gives out as a premium if you join? I used to have about a dozen sets of it there. It's by Will and Ariel Durant. It's about 16 volumes. Well, the co-writer of that Book of the Month Club, History of the World, it's rather well regarded. It's been in print for about 40 or 50 years, was married at 13 to the man she stayed married to for over 50 years. Would she really have been better off doing junior high school homework, do you think? The United States had a successful system of education before we got forced institutional schooling. Then why were the training grounds in boredom we call public schools demanded as a replacement? Even the simple matter of physically confining children, immobilizing them, is known to cause damage to health even in the short run, and it sets up negative patterns which tend to persist lifelong. Why was this done? It's a puzzle. And to solve it, we need to track the idea for childlike, childish, unwholesome, and boring schools back to its origin, at least to its proximate origin. And when we do, we wake up in the northern European nation of Prussia about two centuries ago. By 1820, Prussia was teaching the rest of the world that schools could be efficient training grounds for a managed economy and a managed society. Now, I know some of you say, well, we don't have a managed economy. This is a free market. And I'll accept that from you if you can explain to me why Lockheed can go bankrupt and rise back to life again on the back of your tax money, or why Chrysler can go bankrupt and rise back to health with your tax money as a direct subsidy to it. I could go on for quite a long time about the corporations that haven't been able to compete that are still parts of your daily life. School could create obedient political subjects, incomplete people. That's the key. Incomplete people that the state could finish and adjust as it saw fit. Now, that was Prussia. The mechanism to perform this magic was habit training, sensitizing children to be reflexively responsive to propaganda. How well this scheme worked to concentrate state power, the world was soon to learn in three titanic Prussian-inspired wars between 1871 and 1945. And quite apart from its war-enhancing ability, Prussian habit control schooling served the emerging mass production business empires just coming into being. Early on, German psychology, both hard, what we call behavioral, and soft psychologies, saw that school conditioning could make children susceptible to any sort of authoritarian appeal, including those soft core authoritarianisms of advertising and public relations. A few brilliant minds saw what was at stake. nothing less than a way to overturn Adam Smith's implacable laws of supply and demand. If demand could reliably be created for anything and any idea, a managerial revolution would be at hand. In my own recent memory, the most flagrant example of this is the so-called Iraqi war, which 3 weeks before it began was repudiated by the majority of the American population, a strong majority of the American population, plus 62%. And then, with the help of your tax money and mine, an enormous public relations machine was set in motion, and 3 weeks later, a bare majority of the population was in favor of an attack on Iraq. If opinion could be created, I wanted to give you an example of what I'm talking about here. Managers would be free of the tyranny of public opinion. It could be whatever management wanted, in theory at least. With this in mind, and inspired by Asian successes in crowd management brought back to the United States by traders and by dealers in opium, the founders of compulsory schooling aimed from the beginning to collectivize and socialize, there's a word you hear, isn't it, the ordinary population through the inculcation of the habits and attitudes of dependency. Put simply, they worked to extend childhood well beyond its natural limits by arranging for the removal of young people from home and neighborhood surroundings, from adult company, from real responsibility, and then placing them with total strangers, false kin, for the best part of the day. As schools grew larger and remote bureaucracies selected both teaching personnel and curriculum sequences, it was not uncommon for parents to know nothing at all about the people assigned to be the main companions of their offspring. A situation which would have been regarded as fantastic madness or flagrant tyranny for most of our recorded history was now imposed as a daily routine. And to deepen the estrangement, the teachers only appeared to be central figures in this equation. I could say the teachers, the principals, and the superintendents. Actually, they and their own nominal superiors were themselves under the comprehensive direction of managers completely hidden from public view. It was the ancient Spartan E4 arrangement brought back to life. Just a quick visit to ancient history. In Sparta, unlike in Athens, there was an elected president, two elected houses of representatives, a lower house and a higher house, and those elected groups had no power at all. They had the power to debate openly and to draw the public into one side or another, identifying what their inner loyalties were, but actually they had nothing to do with making Spartan policy. It was made by a group of insiders who were known as the E4s. Ancient history. You get everything at the Link Convention, huh? Parents were given the illusion of being in touch with the people who now controlled much of their children's lives, but it was not so. Now let's go back to James Bryant Conant, the president of Harvard, who gave me my first clue about the actual purposes of forced schooling. In a book published in 1949 called The Child, the Parent, and the State, it will be in every large library in California, Conant stated flatly that our familiar dull schools were the result of a coup. A good coup, he thought. Now, when the president of Harvard makes a statement like that in print, there's a good chance that he knows what he's talking about. Isn't that so? But he didn't analyze the coup in depth in that book. He only referred those interested to a book written in 1918 by another Harvard man, Alexander Inglis, to find out how the coup was pulled off and what it was about. For a long time, I couldn't find Inglis's book anywhere. You won't find it in any library, as far as I know, in the United States. So I settled for looking up the author instead, and I discovered to my delight that the honor lecturer in education at Harvard was named after him. For the last 76 years, the Inglis lecture had been kept alive at America's premier university, and that was reason enough to approach this coup thing with heightened interest. And Inglis himself, the coupmeister, had even more to fascinate the coup hunter with. He had been a second-string All-American football player at Amherst at the turn of the 20th century. This is building to something absolutely explosive. So be patient, though. It's not padding. You have to see who these people are who move among you and talk to you. Inglis was a second-string All-American from Amherst, and he had gone from there to head Houghton Mifflin's secondary education publishing division at a time when that publisher virtually controlled pedagogical publishing. If you wanted to know anything about schools past, present, or what was coming, you read books published by Houghton Mifflin or Macmillan at the turn of the century and for a long time afterwards. So being in charge of the gates of publishing in a secondary school was quite an important thing. In that role, he was able to select what the professional public, superintendents and student teachers alike, got to read about the new school industry being born. Most fascinating of all, though, was Inglis's family. I found out that at the time of the American Revolution, one of his ancestors was busy trying to install a state church in America, the State Church of Britain. That fellow fled from his post as Trinity Church's assistant rector to escape Washington's advancing army. Another Inglis relative had written The Refutation of Tom Paine's Common Sense, which is often considered one of the levers that got us into the American Revolution in the first place, but this ancestor had written a refutation of it and was rewarded by Britain by being named the first Anglican bishop of Nova Scotia. And still another Inglis was commanding general at the Siege of Lucknow in India during the Sepoy Uprising in 1857, and he was promoted to major general for gallantry in the face of those rebellious, there's that word again, rebellion, Sepoy wretches. You'll be glad I took you on this brief excursion. When you hear the six purposes of modern confinement schooling as pronounced by Inglis, and with this context in hand, you are ready to see school as a fifth column placed in the path of the burgeoning American libertarian tradition, which you homeschoolers have brought back to life again, I think single-handedly. Schooling is a surgical incision into which class-based management theories of England, to be precise, were to be subtly inserted into the collective American consciousness to interdict the liberty tradition. By infiltrating the minds of children out of the sight of their parents or any other traditional local authority, the trick would be done. Now, the well-educated will not be shocked. Theories from Plato to Rousseau to Frederick of Prussia knew and taught that if children could be kept childlike or childish beyond its term and nature, if they could be cloistered into a limited society of children, held without any real responsibility except obedience, if their inner lives could be attenuated by removing the insights of history, literature, economics, philosophy, religion, music, and art, if the imminence of death and the certainty of pain and loss in everybody's life could be removed from daily consciousness, if profound reflections on the certainty of one's own death could be replaced with the trivializing emotions of greed, envy, jealousy, and fear, young people would grow older, but they would never grow up. And if they never grew up, a great enduring problem of supervision would be solved. For who here could argue that childish and childlike people aren't easier to manage than critically trained, self-reliant ones? If you're skeptical, you want to keep in mind the words of Lee Iacocca, CEO of Chrysler, spoken out of your earshot in Argentina. Or do you think he was kidding? Educated people are dangerous. Now you're ready to hear Alexander Inglis on the real purposes of schooling. All the categories are in his original. On some of these, I've added a little interpretation to make the meaning clear. The first function of schooling is adjustive. Schools are to establish fixed habits of reaction to authority. Notice that this precludes critical judgment completely. Notice, too, and this is a biggie, that requiring obedience to stupid orders is a much better test of whether the kid's been properly adjusted than asking him or her to follow sensible orders ever could be, because sensible people always follow sensible orders. So you've got to make sure that they've demonstrated that they've seeded their own judgment and will follow stupid orders. Second, recall that this list of six comes to you not from John Gatto, not from a conspiracy theory, but from James Bryant Conant's recommendation that if you wanted to understand what schools really were about, you should get a hold of Alexander Inglis's book, The Principles of Secondary Education. So the second function of schooling is the diagnostic function. School is to diagnose each student's proper social role, logging the evidence mathematically and anecdotally on cumulative records. Third comes the sorting function. School is to sort children by training individuals only so far as their likely destination in the social machine, not one step beyond. The fourth function is conformity, but put out of your mind what you think conformity means. As much as possible, kids are to be made alike, not from any passion for egalitarian ideals, but so their future behavior will be mathematically predictable in service to market and government research. Fifth comes the hygienic function, and once again, put out of your mind whatever you think is meant by the word hygiene. It has nothing here to do with health at all of the individual, but a lot to do with the health of the race, at least as Inglis, Galton, and Darwin saw it. Hygiene is a polite way of saying that school is expected to accelerate natural selection by tagging the unfit so clearly that they will drop from the reproduction sweepstakes or be so inept at parenting that their families will collapse and therefore terminate somewhat further down the line. And last, of the six functions of schooling is what English called the propaedeutic function. That's a fancy word meaning that a small fraction of lucky kids will quietly be taught to take over management of this continuing project, guardians of a population deliberately dumbed down and rendered childlike in order that government and economic life can be managed with a minimum of hassle. Now, it's one thing to say you're going to do all those things. That was 1918. And another to actually do them. What, for instance, would the mechanism look like that could reduce people to a state where they would be compliant in such dispositions? While Britain and Germany had conditioned their own populations for centuries to accept paternalistic direction from the political state, it hadn't happened here. And a project of this magnitude could not just be rammed down citizens' throats. They would have to be taught to actually welcome it, increment by increment, welcome the extension of childhood and the onset of childishness. If at any point public outrage got too loud, the scheme's managers would have to know enough to retract it a bit and wait until under cover of some national emergency like war or depression or other civil unrest, it could be sent racing forward while people were looking elsewhere.
You're listening to John Taylor Gatto, award-winning teacher and author of Dumbing Us Down and Other Critiques of the Educational System. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, or WRFN Nashville. We continue with John Taylor Gatto.
That's how the formidable American ability to read and to argue was deconstructed under the drums and tramplings of World War II. The plan, simplified mightily for the purposes of this talk, called for the infantilization of America, the gradual dumbing down, the gradual demoralization, the slow, steady removal of critical responsibilities from families and their transfer to bureaucrats. What I'm talking about is a radical extension of childhood, principally through schooling at first, but in time through every institution, including and especially popular entertainment, under the direction of a small elite which removes the necessity to entertain oneself. But once again, we need to reiterate that childishness is not an objectionable quality to management, but rather its very justification for being. Childish people are unable to offer effective resistance to management. They may whine, complain, even shoot one another, but they have no idea how things work. Childish people, for all the noise they make, are nearly helpless. Eventually, they fall back into line because they have no other choice. They lack inner resources to be self-sustaining. Through the second half of the 19th century, the North German states of Prussia, Saxony, and Hanover, a science of making young people childish grew up. It was studied by certain prominent Americans like Horace Mann or William Torrey Harris. He was the first national superintendent of schools, by the Peabody family, by J.P. Morgan, and by others who envied Prussia the control it offered to management and wanted that control for itself, themselves. With the rise of the centralized corporate economy, a quarter century after the Civil War, another overriding reason to place the population under tight management come about.
But before I tell you about that one, I want to get a few red herrings out of the way. There were a lot of groups other than the new corporate class that wanted people kept childish for their own reasons. The utopian socialists like Robert Owen and John Ruskin actually thought that an endless childhood, through an endless childhood, an agrarian utopia could be achieved. The evolutionary crowd like Darwin, Galton, and Herbert Spencer thought most of us, I mean a figure as high as 95%, were biologically retarded and could not ever grow up. It would only make trouble to try. Scientific historians like Hegel or Herder or Marx thought that by keeping people dumb and incomplete, history itself could finally be controlled by small elites and guided to a conclusion. There were others too, but we needn't review them all here. I just wanted you to know that although I'm following the trail of the growing corporation, which oddly enough got its start right here in California in the Supreme Court case Santa Clara versus the Southern Pacific Railroad, 1886, is the first time in human history that a corporation is given all the rights that a human being has. It's that case right here in California. Prior to that time, corporate charters lasted 20 years, sometimes a little longer. The corporation could only do what it had written in its charter, saying it could do. It couldn't conglomerate and swallow other corporations. While the liability was limited, the veil could be penetrated very easily. Corporations were never trusted from their inception to be anything other than very, very dangerous ways to make a state prosperous. But in California in 1886, all that ended, and they got the rights of human beings. Corporations were never allowed to interfere in politics in no country that had them. They could not interfere, could come down on either side, let alone both, as we do here to preempt the debate. Anyway, suffice it to say, there were plenty of interests who wanted the public childish, but none had the resources of corporations to sustain a campaign in that direction. We started here with a picture of McDonald's on the screen. I wonder how many of you realize that the federal government passed a law popularly known to themselves as the McDonald's Law, which allowed the minimum wages to be waived by the fast food corporations, and they could pay 20% under the minimum wages. That was during the Nixon administration's freeze on wages and prices. McDonald's was exempted. For a long time, it only required a little corporate financing done behind the scenes to allow an army of innocent academic and philosophical screwballs to do the government corporate bidding unknowingly, thinking they were riding their own hobby horses. Those of you who have ever worked in an American college or university will know this, but I do not think the general public is aware that there is no way to rise in the college university system, no way at all to even retain your job unless you can get corporate grants or foundation grants. Of course, all those foundations are corporate foundations or government grants. You must be able to bring little rivers of money in from the outside, or you last a very short time in the college scene. Well, at that point, getting those grants is life and death. You don't do what you want to get those grants. You put your finger in the wind, find out where the money flow is going, what it wants you to do and say, and that's what you do and say. Now, that's a bit cynical, but I think it's better to raise the notion in your minds that way. I was personally put on the trail of radically extended childhood paid for by business and government by reading the works of Elwood Cubberley, who was a friend of Dr. Conan at Harvard, and Alexander Inglis's partner at Houghton Mifflin, where he edited the elementary school textbooks, and Inglis did the secondary school. Cubberley, another California name, was dean of teacher education at Stanford. And while there, he became head of a thing that used to be called the Education Trust. Thank you, Mike. It is a shadowy cabal of academics nationwide who controlled every major administrative post in America by 1918. If you ever want to read about that particular coup, a nice account exists of it in David Tyack's book, Managers of Virtue, which will be for sale in every graduate school of education in California, hardly a conspiracy book. In 1906, Cubberley wrote in his PhD thesis that in the new schools coming, that is the ones that you've escaped and we all have, that the children were to be shaped and fashioned like nails, and the specifications were to come from business and government in that order. I think if you drive onto the Stanford campus, there's either a Cubberley building or there's a little statue up there to Cubberley. Specifications, of course, are terms for outcomes desired. How those outcomes were to be reached was up to the academics and bureaucrats who worked for the policy people. In business, that's known as managing by objectives. A few years later, in 1919, Cubberley wrote that childhood had been deliberately extended by 4 years after the Civil War because a combination of powerful interests demanded this. That's in his History of Education, but it's not in every edition of it. He's about 20 editions of that book. The trick was pulled off by denying children association with the adult world. That's what socialization's about. And with real responsibility, through comprehensive confinement schooling, which creates a world of children separate from the real world. There the little human resources can be held until summoned. It isn't very hard to see that the interest most directly served by delaying personal sovereignty is something we can call the managerial outlook. Total management and human independence are mutually contradictory terms. Once professionalized, management finds it irresistible to argue that neither children nor parents can be trusted. How many times I heard that in my 30 years in the school business. That the only sensible way to handle growing up is through expert goal setting and professional interventions at public expense. It's time we all face the fact that expert management is never well served by allowing children to grow up, even to grow whole. Its tutelage is justified intellectually by the academic disciplines of psychology, sociology, anthropology, evolutionary biology, even military science, each contending in its own way that growing up is impossible for most of us. All of these disciplines grew from corporate or government underwriting at the beginning of this century or at the end of the 19th, along with the statistical techniques which lend them credibility. Somewhat over 100 years ago, the higher academic voices in America set up a litany which communicated that we would remain children forever, always in need of supervision and regulation, the identical message the Prussians had heard a century before that. One recent piece of evidence that our leaders listened to those voices came to me from a press conference held on TV by Vice President Gore's wife just before the election of 2000. In this press conference, Tipper Gore declared that 55% of the American people were mentally disturbed and in need of therapy, and any humane government would be providing that therapy at no cost. I made that last part up. I don't know if she said that. But Mrs. Gore is only one of a host of commentators urging that we be kept under closer and closer surveillance. When speaking to this question of general irresponsibility, observe how very convenient and useful it is that American classrooms are workshops of rudeness, rowdiness, and danger. How better to instruct the oncoming generations that their only hope of safety lies in expert ministrations. At the end of the 20th century, as I showed you a parody of on the screen, 100,000 American schoolchildren were being barcoded in an experiment to track their passages and see to it that each boy and girl is always where someone else thinks they belong. The profound change in the American bargain with its young, the change that dumbing them down and demoralizing them brought about, wasn't the result of popular demand, nor was it caused by prominent socialists like John Dewey, who are often blamed. The transformation was an undertaking of industrial titans like Andrew Carnegie, J.P. Morgan, Vincent Astor, Commodore Vanderbilt, John D. Rockefeller, Henry Ford, and a few others. The private tax-exempt foundations and elite private boarding schools of these men continue their work to this day. How many times during the presidential election of 2000 did you hear that out of the 20 inner circle elite private boarding schools, places like St. Paul's and Gunnery and Hotchkiss, Groton, that not only did George Bush come, but Al Gore also came? And Gore went to St. Andrews, but it's another one that's religiously affiliated. Bush came from Andover. John McCain, that gritty, down-to-earth populist, came from one of the ritziest of all, called Episcopal High in Washington. Steve Forbes came from Brook. Now, there's four of the five or six candidates coming from 20 private schools with an enrollment of about 20 or 25,000 people totally, maybe a lot less than that. Does that sound statistically likely to you? Anyway, remember, these men, though, weren't interested in fine-tuning your schools. They were only interested in outcomes. They left details to underlings like Henry Kissinger or Zbigniew Brzezinski, and we'll be out of here in a little while. And what is the work they're doing? One way to understand it is to see it as a systematic recreation of the class-based, expert-driven managerial society of Anglican Britain, only this time based in supposedly objective scientific principles. Why would an economic leadership committed to Adam Smith's capitalistic principles veer in this decidedly socialistic direction? Fortunately, these men tell us why in their own essays and memoirs and letters and occasional writings that I've been reading for the last 10 years, God forgive me, and are all in that book out there. Carnegie and Rockefeller, for instance, both despised competition. I mean, they went into a blue funk when the idea that competition was the key to our vitality was mentioned. They thought it was irrational and a huge waste of time. As purely rational thinkers, they worked with might and main to stamp it out and replace it with a planetary form of government which would resemble the British Empire and its Anglican corporate theology, only be better and more efficient. By the last quarter of the 19th century, the promise of unlimited energy coupled with mass production machines. Remember that a century earlier, coal wasn't used anywhere. There weren't any trains at all. Oil was some sort of a nuisance, that, and again, natural gas that burned off in your fields. But now they had this blank check for energy, and they knew that coupled with mass production machinery, that an industrial utopia could finally come about. But personal liberty and conventional morality would have to be surrendered if that promise was going to be realized. Indeed, as I told you earlier, even the law of supply and demand would be forced to give way. But how were they going to get rid of the libertarian American past? And if you put yourself in these guys' position, I think you see it's a huge task to replace family and tradition and religion. There is nowhere else to start but with children. So drawing on the method pioneered in Prussia, the quick arrival of young Americans at responsible maturity had to be ended. And this is my final, I think, idea to leave with you. It had to be ended because financial capital demanded it. Why would anybody make the huge investments that mass production machinery calls for, machinery that's certain to obsolete itself down the line in 4 or 5 years? Why would anyone make those investments unless profit could be guaranteed? Markets assured. Unless this could be done, capital wasn't going to be forthcoming. Now, assuring markets is an old game. Britain had been doing it for centuries. Competition is muted through trust formation, through government regulation, through government subsidies that stack the market deck, and in other ways unknown to the butcher, the baker, and the candlestick maker. But not so easy was convincing our uniquely productive population to give up its traditional yearning for independent livelihoods. When the lady asked the audience this morning how many people were doing homeschooling in conjunction with a home business, it was about 35% or 40% of the room, which was as filled as this room is now. That's what had to be put to death. The perils of overproduction would frighten away the investments that industrial growth depended on. The majority of the people would have to be retrained to think of itself as employees and as consumers instead of producers. Even consumers of centrally produced entertainment. Forget the fact that when I was growing up in the 40s, people were singing all the time, not so they could go to Hollywood or get on the charts. There were just singing groups everywhere. There were acting groups everywhere. You couldn't walk down the street on Saturday or Sunday. There must have been 400 painters sitting out in the streets of Monongahela, Pennsylvania. And so mass schooling of a compulsory nature was given teeth between 1905 and 1915. It was no longer charged with fashioning good people or good citizens. Now it was directed, as it had been in Germany, to the inculcation of habits, fears, appetites, and attitudes useful to management. That's all you need to know to understand what standardized testing is about. Keep in mind, thank you. The scheme was never intended, this is the hardest part to swallow, to be destructive, just the reverse. By converting Americans into specialized economic and social functions, into incompletely human beings, this nation eventually achieved the most reliable domestic market in the world. The human mutilations of schooling are a trade-off for this prosperity, comfort, and security are achieved at the price of personal sovereignty and wholeness. That's what makes extended childhood a paradox. Give it up, and the society will enter a zone of great turbulence, since most people don't have a clue what to do to make a living or how to entertain themselves. And the resolution of that turbulence, nobody can predict, except you and me. Once, because you've already done it. Once you see its logic, the mechanisms of forced schooling are fairly simple to avoid. Well-schooled children are trained to reflexively obey strangers' commands and to continually seek the judgment of strangers. Later on, after school is done, advertising and advocacy journalism paid for by advertisers slip easily into the role of school teacher. Well-schooled people have a low threshold of boredom. They need constant novelty to feel alive. With only the flimsiest inner life, they must stay in touch with official voices through television, radio, internet, cell phone, commercial music, and other commercial entertainments, pop journalism, and shallow friendships turned over on a regular basis. They cannot sit still without their minds wandering off to some commercial world or to the stock market. Changing classes at short intervals is a drill to prepare kids for changing associates, domiciles, mates, and possessions in dizzying and eternal profusion. A climate of low-level dissatisfaction is the very air that centralized mass production economies must breathe, and therefore it is practiced in school. Well-schooled people must be poorly trained in history, philosophy, economics, literature, poetry, music, art, theology, and anything known to develop a personal inner life. Well-schooled people need lifelong tutelage, cradle-to-grave schooling to make any sense of their days. Mass entertainment and mass journalism provide that tutelage long after school is done. What to do about this personally? What to do about it collectively as a society demands that we have to wake up to what school has evolved into. It's a service of big business and big government. If you seek a change in schooling, you're going to have to repudiate that fatal belief that if only government could be given more control, or only business, then all would sort itself out. What to do about it personally? Learn to be a saboteur of this thing. And I know I'm preaching to the choir here. Throw sand into the gears of the machine whenever you can. There's no way to reform it, since it does exactly what it was designed to do. And recognize that the blessing that extended childhood brings to managers and the prosperity it invests the economy with by converting spirits designed for independence into whining, greedy, bored children who define themselves by what they consume is a prize too contemptible to be worth the cost. When you next find yourself appalled by infantile and irresponsible behavior that you see all around you, think of school as its forge and try to get rid of it. Thank you. God bless. Thank you very much. It was worth living to 70. Now you sit down and I'll give you a standing ovation.
You have been listening to a speech by John Taylor Gatto. This speech was provided by Friends on Pendragon and given in the year 2001 by John Taylor Gatto when he was 70 years old.
You've been listening to John Taylor Gatto, award-winning teacher and author of Dumbing Us Down and other books critical of the educational system. Thanks to Scott Frasher for that tape. Some community announcements for local listeners in the Finger Lakes. Speaking of teachers, the Tompkins County Living Wage Coalition will be sending Walmart back to school. And they are asking for as many educators, teachers at all levels, school paraprofessionals, and other school staff to join them at a press conference in Ithaca on Wednesday, August 24th, from 2 to 2:30 p.m. at the Department of Social Services building at 320 West State Street in the Beverly Live Say Room on the first floor. The National Education Association, the American Federation of Teachers, and the New York State United Teachers have joined with the Living Wage Coalition and others in a national campaign to hold Walmart accountable for its falling grades and to get them to change their practices. The aim is to educate the public about the harmful effect of Walmart's business practices on its employees, children, our community, and the economy, and to get Walmart to change. For more information, contact Carl Foyer at the Tompkins County Living Wage Coalition at 607-269-0409. There is no such thing as too late. Funds are still available to cover the journeys of local people to Crawford, Texas, to take part in the vigil with Cindy Sheehan. For more information, contact Howard Engelskirchen at area code 607-387-5951 or email Howard E. at twcny.rr.com. Priority will be given to military families. In addition, organizers want to ensure representation from communities of color. Everyone is invited to find out what is happening at the Finger Lakes Democracy School. Come to a social hour and film showing Saturday, August 27th from 7 to 9 p.m. at Cabin Hall Watson Homestead in Painted Post. The event is free. The film being shown is Taken for a Ride, GM and Public Transit, answering the question, why does America have the worst public transit in the industrialized world and the most freeways? The Watson Homestead is located at 9620 Dry Run Road in Painted Post, New York. That's Saturday, August 27th. From 7 to 9 p.m. You can download an MP3 of this and previous Unwelcome Guests episodes at our website, unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.
The Rangers and deputies are hired by the rich man. Catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will always be filled by unwelcome.